As I mentioned in the announcement portion, this past last day of Unleavened Bread, I'm going to enter into a subject that was given to me. Somebody had asked a question, and while I could have answered the question in our question and answer Bible study, I thought that perhaps it would be good to go through this particular question and kind of expand it a little bit more into a full Bible study. So let me share with you at the beginning here the question. The person writes, when I read Matthew chapter 25, verses 31 through 46, which is the parable of the sheep and the goats, I wonder what the best way to apply it in my life and often have guilty feelings that come upon me when I read it and knowing I have not taken action, not necessarily in volunteering, but anytime an opportunity presents itself and how I didn't act on it or even avoided a situation. How can we say we have a heart that wants to help, but we don't act on it? So obviously the person is writing and there's a question there of wanting to help and needing to help, but at the same time, what if I don't act on it? Am based upon the parable here, as we'll see, is it something that, because again, the parable deals with punishment in terms of eternal life and those sorts of things. It is in a sense, it is a warning parable. So how do you apply this particular parable and how do we find the balance in this particular parable and what is the parable actually telling us? Doing good works, as the individuals writing this question, again, is something that we understand is a predominant subject in the Bible. We are called, in part as first fruits in God's family, to do good works. But it then enters into the next question, and that is, how far should we go in necessarily doing good works? For example, we all, in our daily travels here and there around the Northwest, we come in contact with our fair number of panhandlers, people begging for money. If you were to give money to every individual out on the street, you would go broke. There's no way that you could possibly do that. The other situation that you look at in terms of doing good is, are we, in terms of what we are doing, are we causing the person to be reliant on the handout rather than helping them or having them work towards a cure for their particular problem? I think in the back of our minds sometimes, especially for myself, when I see a number of people out on the street panhandling and begging, when you read some of the stories and when you hear some of the stories that you recognize that there's a lot of substance abuse that goes into a situation of a lot of people that are homeless. That's not the case in every situation, but it does tend to be a very predominant situation with regards to homelessness, that somewhere along the line people have gotten involved in substance abuse, either drugs and or alcohol. And they've basically alienated themselves from all members of their family. They don't have anybody else, and so they turn to the streets. So in doing good, we often ask the question, if I'm giving somebody money and they claim they need it for food or shelter, whatnot, are they actually going to use that money for doing that? Am I actually facilitating bad behavior then by giving them money? In other words, I guess what we're saying here is, are there limits to what we should do? I think you go back to a realization in terms of understanding certain things as we'll go through here, is that we simply cannot help every individual person that exists in society today. We ultimately know that the answer to the problems for so many needy people that exist in the world today is the coming of the kingdom of God. Now, that doesn't mean we simply say, well, I can't help you. You'll just have to wait until Christ returns and establishes the government of God on earth. It's more than that. I mean, it's we look forward to that, but at the same time, we're going to see this parable, and it tells us that there are things that we should be doing. But there are limits that are also based. If you take a look at what the parable says, there are limits based upon what he says. So let's go into this particular study. Again, I've titled it The Parable of the Sheep and the Goats, and exactly how far do we go? So we're going to learn some things from this parable of the sheep and the goats. What does it actually say? And what are some of the lessons, again, in the parable that Jesus Christ wants to teach the disciples as he goes through this particular story? So let's pick it up here in Matthew chapter 25, beginning in verse 31. Let's go ahead and read through the entire parable. Matthew chapter 25, beginning in verse 31. He says, when the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the holy angels with him, then he will sit on the throne of his glory. All the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate them one from another, as a shepherd divides his sheep from the goats. And he will set the sheep on his right hand, but the goats on the left. Then the king will say to those on his right hand, come, you blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. Verse 35, for I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you took me in. I was naked and you clothed me. I was sick and you visited me. I was in prison and you came to me. Then the righteous will answer him, saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry and fed you, or thirsty and gave you drink? When did we see you a stranger and take you in, or naked and clothe you? Or when did we see you sick or in prison and come to you? And the king will answer and say to them, assuredly I say to you, inasmuch as you did it to one of the least of these brethren, you did it to me. Then he will say to those on the left hand, depart from me, you cursed, into the everlasting fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me no food. I was thirsty, and you gave me no drink. I was a stranger, and you did not take me in. Naked, and you did not clothe me. Sick and in prison, and you did not visit me. Then they will also answer him, saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or naked or sick in our prison and did not minister to you? Then he will answer them, saying, assuredly I say to you, insomuch as you did not do it to one of the least of these, you did not do it to me. And there, and these will go away into everlasting punishment, but the righteous into eternal life. So what was it that Jesus Christ was talking about here? And is there a correlation essentially between us not doing good and receiving a punishment? Again, the importance of this particular parable we look at, we must go back to context. What is the context with which Jesus Christ is writing this particular parable? You have to go back to Matthew chapter 24. Now, remember again, understanding of the Bible, that many years after the gospel accounts were written, it was, again, scholars that came in and they put in the chapter breaks, they put in the verses. Matthew did not write, okay, chapter 24, and begin to write the Olivet prophecy out and write one verse and then the second verse and such and such and so forth. That is, again, a scholar that came in and they would, again, write these chapter breaks in, write these particular verses. So when we look at the Olivet prophecy, you have to understand that it actually bleeds right into chapter 25, because, again, naturally speaking, there is no chapter break here when it was actually happening and occurring back in 31 AD when Matthew was writing this just prior to what would be the time when Jesus Christ would be arrested, taken away, crucified, and again, die and be resurrected. But let's look at the context here, again, of what we're saying with regards to this parable. Matthew chapter 24, we want to go back a couple of pages to the Olivet prophecy and notice what it says here in verse 3. Matthew chapter 24 and verse 3 says, now as he, speaking of Jesus Christ, sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately saying, tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? So that is the question that they are asking him. What is going to be the sign of your coming? What is going to be the end of the age? This would be the question that he would then, or that would then trigger the Olivet prophecy here in Matthew chapter 24. What occurs in this chapter is an outline of what's going to happen at prior to the return of Jesus Christ's second coming. Now, again, we don't have the time to go through that. That's not the purpose of the study this evening. But we know that the devastation is vast, and we know that it is widespread, and we know that it must happen. These are the things that physically must happen and occur in order for Christ to return and bring about the government of God on earth. But remember that we go from Matthew chapter 24 now into Matthew chapter 25. What is the first thing we read after this Olivet prophecy that's going on? And without a chapter break, we know that he goes right into the parable of what? He goes into the parable of the 10 virgins. Five wise, five foolish. And we go through that whole parable, understanding and realizing that these were 10 individuals. They all had the same knowledge. They had the same understanding, but only five of them did what they were supposed to do. The other five were foolish, did not have the oil when the bridegroom came. They tried to light their lamps, and the five wise were able to. The five foolish were not. The five foolish wanted to get oil from the five wise. The five wise says, no, we don't have enough. You've got to do for yourself. And again, he then, after that particular parable, he goes into the kingdom of heaven being likened onto what? He talks about it being likened onto a man who gave talents. He was going away, and he was going to give talents to these three particular servants. So we go from a warning parable here in regards to the 10 virgins. Then he moves into the parable of the talents, which has to do with diligently doing the work of God and always growing spiritually, not taking that one talent that the one had, burying it in the ground, figuring that this was an austere, a hard man. He knew his master was this hard and austere man. He said, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to take this talent, and I'm simply going to bury it in the ground so that when you return, it's there. We know the end result of that. But then we see here in Matthew chapter 25, the third parable that, again, is all tied to the Olivet prophecy. So he's talking about a timeline in terms of what should happen, what should occur as he goes through when will be your return. He goes through all these things, and then he gives them these warning parables about what they are to be doing. Again, making certain and sure that our lamps are full of oil, making certain and sure that we're diligently doing the work of God, as the parable of the talents tells us, and continue to grow spiritually. The parable of the sheep and the goats has to do with growing in a self-sacrificing love. Now, again, I use that term self-sacrificing love because that's important when you go back and understand that the love of God, again, does not expect something in return. The love of God is there. It's not simply a conditional. We talk about the love of God being unconditional. God loves us unconditionally. We understand and realize that even in spite of that fact, we may sin, we might fall short, but does that mean that God does not love us? No, he still loves us. So when I talk about this self-sacrificing love, people can show a form of love, but to have a self-sacrificing love is much different than just having a love or showing an outward love. When you're willing to sacrifice, and generally what we're talking about here, as we see in this particular parable, is that you're willing to sacrifice your time. You're willing to give of whatever resources that you have, and maybe just on a limited basis, but whatever resources you might have so that you can help someone who is definitely in need. So we go to this parable, the sheep and the goats. The analogy is clear here that Jesus Christ is trying to show us is that we are to be sheep and we are not to be goats. Now, is there anything wrong with a goat? Well, no. A goat is a clean animal. A goat can be eaten. I mean, in Africa, that is something that many of those African nations at the Feast of Tabernacles, for many of those brethren, they don't get meat throughout the year, or they may get it very sparsely, very occasionally. But when it comes to the Feast of Tabernacles, oftentimes that is a delicacy for them to have goat at the Feast of Tabernacles. We wouldn't look at it the same way. We think of the goat here in the Western world, and we think of what we might want at the Feast of Tabernacles. And the last thing we do when we go to the Feast of Tabernacles is say, I'm really looking forward to having some goat. But again, it's a clean animal. But Jesus Christ is drawing a contrast here between the sheep and the goats. And he's showing a contrast between righteous sheep and selfish goats. Now, goats, generally, physically speaking, have certain tendencies. If you know anything about animals, goats tend to be self-willed. They're not really willing to follow. They are animals that will oftentimes eat anything. If you've ever noticed, I've seen them. I can't remember the last time I saw it, but there'll be a cartoon picture of a goat, like a billy goat, standing on top of an old abandoned car. And I remember seeing this particular picture, and he's got this, it looks like a tin can, and it looks like he's chewing this tin can in his mouth. It's kind of hanging from his mouth, and he's trying to get the food out of this tin can. Goats are animals that will eat anything. So they're not really willing to follow. They're self-willed. Sheep, on the other hand, tend to be very docile. They're gentle. you can get into a sheep pen and they will tend to want to rub up against you once they get familiar with you. Goats, not so much, especially if you've got a billy goat. They'll put their head down and they will try to ram you. Jesus is telling us in this particular parable of the sheep and the goats is that we want to be sheep in terms of selfless service of others. We want to be docile. We want to be gentle. We want to be kind. It is interesting to note that one of the statements that Jesus Christ makes in chapter 24 here of the book of Matthew, and I believe it pertains to this particular parable. Jump back a page to Matthew chapter 24 and verse 12. Notice what it says here, Matthew chapter 24 and verse 12. He says, "And because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold." So we know that that is a condition that will occur at the end time. We know that society will become colder and colder. But again, you recognize that this is something in terms that this lawlessness abounding is more from the standpoint of an attitude or analogy that would have a goat rather than a sheep. Sheep would not be seen as lawless. They are gentle, they're docile, they're kind. They're not viewed in the same way as a goat might be interpreted or seen. Let's take a look at 2 Timothy chapter 3. Let's go look at a familiar passage of Scripture. Again, going along with this whole concept again of a lawlessness that would exist, the love of many would grow cold. 2 Timothy chapter 3, again, we'll begin in verse 1. We'll go through verse 5, all the way through verse 5. This is, again, the Apostle Paul giving us what I often refer to as a laundry list of attitudes or conditions that would exist at the time of the end. 2 Timothy chapter 3, notice beginning here in verse 1. He says, "But know this, that in the last days perilous times will come." That word perilous in the Greek means fierce. It means fierce. "For men will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, unloving, unforgiving, slanderers without self-control, brutal, despisers of good, traitors, headstrong, haughty, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, having a form of godliness but denying its power, and from such people turn away." So, again, as I said, these are conditions that would exist at the time of the end. We don't have to go very far to recognize that we see all of those conditions that exist in the world around us today. Notice what it says there in verse 2, "For men will be lovers of themselves." That is a term that can be used for an individual who is self-centered. Remember what we just read in Matthew chapter 24 and verse 12, which again ties through to chapter 25, with the parable of the sheep and the goats, that because lawlessness would abound, the love of many would wax cold. Because why? Because men will be lovers of themselves. They will have these self-centered lives. They're not interested in helping. They're not interested in caring about other individuals. They're only interested in what they can get for themselves. And that is where we draw this correlation, as he said here, that these two groups of people that would exist, the sheep and the goats. Again, he's speaking to those of us in the church and understand and realize the importance of having a life that is not self-centered, but truly is a life that is designed to be growing in self-sacrificing love, the same type of love that Jesus Christ showed, the same type of love that God the Father has. Luke chapter 6, let's go back to Luke chapter 6 and take a look at another passage here. Luke chapter 6, again, with the same context of giving, the self-sacrificed and giving attitude that we are supposed to have, which is the parable is trying to show us. Luke chapter 6. Luke chapter 6, and let's notice verse 32. We'll go all the way to verse 36. Luke chapter 6, beginning in verse 32. He says, "But if you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners love those who love them." So the concept here is, if you're doing good works to somebody who's going to love you anyways, what's the point? That's the point that he's making here. You can give to those who already have everything they need. What good does that do? As he says there in verse 32, love those that love you. Well, great. So what difference does that make? What credit is that to you? Notice verse 33. "And if you do good to those who do good to you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners do the same. And if you lend to those from whom you hope to receive back, what credit is that to you? For even sinners lend to sinners to receive as much back. Notice what he says in verse 35. But love your enemies, do good and lend, hoping for nothing in return, and your reward will be great. You'll be sons of the Most High, for he is kind to the unthankful and evil. Therefore, be merciful, just as your Father also is merciful. The context here that Christ is saying is that you are giving, you're showing this self-sacrificing love of giving, and you're expecting nothing in return. You know, giving something to someone and expecting something in return is not, that's not giving. That is not giving. You're expecting something in the end result of what you have done. What's it going to profit me? What's it going to give me? That's not giving. It's absolutely not giving. That Christ is, again, cautioning that particular attitude in terms that, that people would have. Notice 1 John chapter 4 and verse 20. 1 John chapter 4 and verse 20. Notice what it says here. 1 John chapter 4 and verse 20. 1 John chapter 4 and verse 20. Notice what it says here. He says, if someone says, I love God and hates his brother, he is a liar. For he who does not love his brother whom he has seen, how can he love God whom he has not seen? The individual that says, you know, I don't care about this person, I don't care about that person, and they can see that person, they can see that person in need and say, I don't care about them. The point John's making here, how can you say you can't love those who you see, but then you say, well, I love God, and you've never seen God? There's a contradiction in terms there, and John goes so far as to say, you're a liar. You're a liar if you say you love God, but you don't love an individual that you can see. James chapter 2 and verse 16. Let's go over there quickly. James chapter 2 and verse 16. James chapter 2 and verse 16. Let's start in verse 15, actually. Verse 15 and then verse 16. He says, if a brother or sister is naked and destitute of daily food, and one of you says to them, depart in peace, be warm and filled, but you do not give them the things which are needed for the body, what does it profit? It's a statement that we often talk about, you know, talking about, oh, kind thoughts, be warm and filled. Well, when you, again, the statement that James is making here, when you have a brother or sister, when you have someone who has a need and you don't fulfill that need and you just simply say, well, I'm thinking about you. How does that really profit the person to just simply say, be warm and filled? That's not, again, showing a self-sacrificing love. Let's look at an example here in Mark chapter 6 of Jesus Christ. Mark chapter 6. Again, I realize I'm going through a lot of scriptures here at the very beginning. Mark chapter 6 and verse 31. Mark chapter 6. Let's begin in verse 31. It's a long passage of scripture here. Mark chapter 6, beginning in verse 31. And he said to them, come aside by yourselves to a deserted place and rest a while. And for there were many coming and going, and they did not even have time to eat. So they departed to a deserted place in the boat by themselves. But the multitude saw them departing, and many knew him and ran there on foot from all the cities. They arrived before them and came together to him. And Jesus, when he came out, saw a great multitude and was what? Overwhelmed? Not. They're following him again? No. He was moved with compassion for them. He was moved with compassion for them because they were like sheep not having a shepherd. So he began to teach them many things. Now, when the day was far spent, his disciples came to him and said, this is a deserted place and already the hour is late. Send them away that they may go into the surrounding country and villages and buy themselves bread, for they have nothing to eat. But he answered and said to them, you give them something to eat. And they said to him, shall we go and buy 200 denarii worth of bread and give them something to eat? But he said to them, how many loaves do you have? Go and see. When they found out, they said, 5 and 2 fishes. Then he commanded them to make them all sit down in groups on the green grass. So they sat down in ranks, in hundreds and in fifties. When he had taken the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, he looked up to heaven, blessed and broke the loaves and gave them to the disciples to set before them. The 2 fish he divided among them all. So they all ate and were filled, and they took up 12 baskets full of fragments and of fish. And now those who had eaten the loaves were about 5,000 men. Doesn't tell the full story. Because again, in the Bible, oftentimes when it says that the men are referred to, but it does not take into account the women and children that would have been along with them. So this was probably closer to somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 to 12, maybe even 15,000 people that were fed with these five loaves and two fish. But my point in all of this is going back to what he said. When he saw that multitude, he was moved with compassion. It shows the example of a self-sacrificing love. He didn't know all of those individuals. He didn't know who they were. He didn't know them by name. Again, these were people that were following him. They wanted to be taught. They wanted to be heard. As it said, they knew where he was going, and so they went because they wanted to hear Jesus Christ. My point being is that he shows this level of compassion. He shows this level of a self-sacrificing love. We find that is a predominant theme throughout the Bible in terms of selfless service. Service in the Bible is something that we understand and recognize it's our duty, it's our responsibility, but we also understand that there's a selfless side to that we simply serve. We often make the statement that serving is its reward. If I serve, am I going to get something in return? If I do this, what's in it for me? The point, again, that we find throughout the Bible is serving and service of others. Service is its own reward. Let's take a look at the Bible because, again, we find that it is full of stories of selfless service. But there are a few that we want to look at here briefly and go through and review. Let's start in Genesis chapter 19. In Genesis chapter 19, we're going to read just three verses here. Genesis chapter 19, verses 1 through 3. Now, there's a few things that we'll pick up in this particular story. This is the story, again, of two strangers that came into Sodom, and Lot insisted that they come and they stay at his house. Now, remember, again, the record here shows that these were two strangers. These were not people he knew. This wasn't Harry and Fred. This wasn't Sally and Martha. This wasn't two individuals that Lot knew. They were referred to as strangers. He told them to come in, and he not only took them in, but he fed them. Notice what it says here in Genesis chapter 19, beginning in verse 1. Now the two angels came to Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom. When Lot saw them, he rose to meet them, and he bowed himself with his face toward the ground, and he said, Now, my lords, please, turn into your servant's house and spend the night and wash your feet, that you may rise early and go on your way. And they said, no, but we will spend the night in the open square. They were not even willing to accept the hospitality that Lot was offering. Verse 3, but he insisted strongly. He insisted strongly. I won't take no for an answer. You come, you spend the night with me, you wash up, I'll give you a meal. He insisted strongly, so they turned into him and entered his house. Then he made them a feast and baked unleavened bread, and they ate. So again, two strangers that show up said, no, we'll go sleep in the square, a public place here. We don't want to bother you. We don't want you to worry. He said, no, I insist. You stay here. You wash up. I'll make you something to eat, and you can spend the night here. So again, we have one story here of selfless service. Let's look at another, Genesis chapter 24. Genesis chapter 24. In Genesis chapter 24, we find the story of Rebekah. We find the story of Rebekah. Abraham is going to send out his servant, obviously looking for a wife for his son Isaac. And so he is sending out the servant, and again, we're going to see that in, verse 10, the servant took 10 of his master's camels. Now, again, I think everybody knows about camels. Camels can go a long time without water, but when you eventually do water a camel, the term used for watering animals, he's giving them water, watering them, they're going to drink a lot of water. Notice the story here. We're going to pick it up in Genesis chapter 24 and verse 18. Servant ran to meet her. Please bring me, verse 17, and drink a little water from your pitcher. So she said, drink, my lord. She quickly let her pitcher down to her hand and gave him a drink. And when she had finished giving him a drink, she says, I will draw water for your camels also until they have finished drinking. Now, again, how much water would you have to give one camel? Again, these are animals that are desert type, arid climate. They're able to travel long distances without water. But once they go to water, they're going to drink for a long time. Here she's drawing enough water. I mean, how much time would it have taken to water 10 camels? The point being, it's a lot of time. She didn't know who this was, but she was willing to go ahead and not only give him water, but make certain and sure that she got enough water for 10 thirsty camels. Let's go over to 1 Kings chapter 18. 1 Kings chapter 18. We find another example of selfless service. 1 Kings chapter 18 and verse 13. This is the story of Obadiah, who was the servant, one of Ahab's servants, and he was responsible for hiding 100 men of the Lord's prophets, 50 to a cave, and fed them with bread and water. And again, he refers that story and lets Elijah know it. Again, in the midst of this terrible drought, he's not only going to hide individuals from Ahab and, again, Jezebel, who, if she knew, she would have cut their throats, she would have killed them. But not only is he going to do that, hide them, he's also going to give them water, which would be a precious commodity in the middle of a drought. 1 Kings chapter 18, and notice verse 13. He says, "Was it not reported to my Lord what I did when Jezebel killed the prophets of the Lord, how I hid 100 men of the Lord's prophets, 50 to a cave, and fed them with bread and water?" So again, an act of selfless service. Again, as I said, in the middle of a tremendous drought, you look at that and say, well, you know, you've got to conserve your resources because you're in the middle of the drought, but you're giving water to individuals that Jezebel would have killed. Let's look at another example here of selfless service. We find it over in Acts chapter 9. Acts chapter 9. In Acts chapter 9, we are introduced to a woman by the name of Dorcas, also named Tabitha. Acts chapter 9, and notice verse 36. It says, "At Joppa there was a certain disciple named Tabitha, which is translated Dorcas. This woman was full of good works and charitable deeds, which she did." It's interesting to note how Luke writes in the book of Acts. So he refers to this particular woman. We don't know anything about her other than the fact is what he tells her is that she was full of good works and charitable deeds, which she did. Drop down to verse 39 and notice what it says. She got sick and she dies. And in verse 39, notice what it says. "When Peter came and arose and went with them, when he had come, they brought him in the upper room, and all the widows stood by him weeping, showing the tunics and garments which Dorcas had made while she was with them." Now, again, this would not have been just one or two individuals. This would have been a number of ladies who were standing there. These widows, again, all stood by weeping, and their weeping is then a result of Tabitha or Dorcas's death, and showing Peter all of the clothing that she had made for them. Now, again, there had to be a number of them. How many there were, we don't really know, but the level of selfless service that she did was tremendous enough that it impacted, again, and Luke was inspired by God to record her name and what she did here in terms of her selfless service. So again, and another interesting example. Let's look at one more. Let's look at one more. Hebrews chapter 10. Now, Hebrews, and again, I recognize that some may say, well, do we really know that the Apostle Paul wrote Hebrews? I will simply tell you that I believe that Hebrews was written by the Apostle Paul. The reason that some people wonder if it was written by the Apostle Paul is it doesn't have his normal signature at the beginning of the letter. I, Paul, a prisoner of the Lord, or I, Paul, a bond slave of Jesus Christ. That's normally how he would start his letters. In this letter, he does not. Some would say that may have been because his eyesight had gotten so bad that he was having someone else pen the letter, and it was perhaps a situation where that was omitted or the person forgot to put it in, whatever it might be. But again, if you look at the writing style of Hebrews, you would say that it does reflect the other letters of the epistles of Paul. So again, when I make the statement, I'm simply saying that I believe that the author of Hebrews is the Apostle Paul. But notice what it says here, Hebrews chapter 10 and verse 34. Again, another reason why I believe that we're talking about Paul here writing this letter. He says, "For you had compassion on me in my chains and joyfully accepted the plundering of your goods, knowing that you have a better and an enduring possession for yourselves in heaven." So he praised them. He praised them because they had compassion upon him. And while he was in prison, while he was in chains, and they gave of what they had for him while he was in prison. It says you accepted the plundering of your goods, the taking of some of the things that you had to help me out in my time of need. My point here is that these are just a few examples that we have throughout the Bible of selfless service of individuals. Now, we can ask the question, how far do we go? Again, I made that statement at the beginning as we started to introduce this subject. How far do we go? If you look at homeless people, if you look at those that panhandle, if you look at those that are looking for a handout, how far do we go in that particular situation? What is the parable of the sheep and the goats actually telling us? Are there limits to what we can and what we should do? Well, I think we're going to see some lessons that we can pick up from the parable of the sheep and the goats. And again, that's what I want to kind of go through here in the latter half of this particular study. Several points here that I'm going to bring out. The first point that I want to bring out with regards to what the parable of the sheep and the goats is telling us is this first point, and that is our judgment is not based upon the knowledge we have amassed, it is what we have done. Now, right away you're going to go and say, well, doesn't that tell us that we're supposed to grow in the grace and the knowledge of our Lord Jesus Christ? And the answer to that is yes. But my point is, what do you do with that knowledge? Do you just have knowledge for the sake of knowledge? Knowledge from the sake of standpoint of going to school, amassing all this knowledge so you can regurgitate it on an exam or a test or whatever it might be. That is not why we gain the knowledge. We gain the knowledge of what we are to do, and then we do what we have been commanded or what we have been told to do. So again, this first point that I'm drawing is our judgment is not based upon the knowledge we have amassed. It is what we have done with it. If you look at the knowledge of the three servants that were given the talents, based upon knowledge, they all had the same knowledge. They all knew that the king was going, that the master was going, and that at some point he was going to come back. Now again, they all had received different numbers of talents. So look at it from the standpoint of the knowledge they had. They all had the same knowledge of what was going to happen, what was going to occur. But it's what they did with what they were given. You see, that's what's important. And that's what's important from the standpoint of the sheep and the goats. What is it that we have been given and what are we doing with it? Let's go back to Matthew chapter 24. So the first kind of point that we want to draw, or the first sort of lesson from this parable, is that we have to be doing. We cannot just simply say, well, I've got this knowledge, I have this understanding, and therefore that's all I need. Matthew chapter 24 tells us about all these events that are going to happen. All these events that are going to come about is prior to Christ's return. That's all well and fine. People want to study prophecy. They get locked in on prophecy, and that's all well and good to understand and know, so you can understand what's happening in the world around us today as it draws closer and closer. But what are we doing with the knowledge we have? Notice Matthew chapter 24, Matthew chapter 24, verse 45. He says, "Who then is a faithful and wise servant whom his master made ruler over his household to give them food in due season?" Verse 46, "Blessed is that servant whom his master, when he comes, will find him," or will find so doing. Our calling that we have been given is not to fame and fortune. Ours is a calling to be a servant. We are following the example of the greatest servant that ever lived, Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ was always working. He continues to work to this day. Let's take a look at a couple of scriptures that tell us that. John chapter 5. Jesus Christ, when he was again human and then finally killed, resurrected, and is now sitting at the right hand of God, he's not just sitting there doing nothing, idly waiting and doing nothing. Notice what he says here, John chapter 5 and verse 17. He's not sitting at the right hand of God simply saying, okay, I'll wait when the time comes, I'm in ready position, and when he sends me back to this earth, then I'll get back to doing work. He's working to this day. Notice what John chapter 5 and verse 17 says. "But Jesus answered them, my Father has been working until now, and I have been working." God and the Father are working. That work does not end. That work continues to this very day. John chapter 14, let's look at another passage of Scripture. John chapter 14, let's take a look at verses 1 through 3. This is, again, passage that we read every evening at the Passover. John chapter 14, verses 1 through 3. He says, "Let not your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may be also." So he makes the statement, "I go to prepare a place." If you're preparing something, it means you're working. You're working. So again, his statement saying that my Father's house are many mansions and I go to prepare a place, even after they left him, he's continuing to work to this very day. So we follow that example. Our judgment's based not upon the knowledge we have amassed, but on what we are doing or what we have done. What's the second point we draw from the parable of the sheep and the goats? It is to help in simple things. Let's go back to Matthew chapter 25. Let's go back to that parable. Matthew chapter 25. And let's lift out again just those verses specifically that he's talking about. Matthew chapter 25. Notice what he says here, beginning in verse 35. He says, "For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you took me in. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me." So he lists certain things here. Hungry, what do? You give food. Thirsty, you give drink. Stranger, you welcome them. There's hospitality. Naked, you give them clothing. Sick, you visited them. Prison, you visited them. What's the common denominator in all of these things? They're all rather simple things. They're all rather simple things. We look at someone who might have need and offering them food or offering them drink. We have someone that might have need of some clothes. Maybe they don't have clothes that they can use or that they can wear. Had a situation happen years ago with an individual, again, in another area that needed a ride to the Passover. He hadn't been in our area for a couple of years. I knew the individual, contacted me, needed a ride, wanted to know when Passover was, wanted to know if I could arrange for someone to pick him up to take in Passover so he could take the Passover. Also told me he had gained some weight since the last time I'd seen him and he didn't have anything suitable to wear to the Passover service. So I asked him, "Yeah, what's your waist size? What size shirt do you wear?" And I simply went over to Deseret Industries, which is in Salt Lake City. It's the equivalent of Goodwill, and was able to get him a pair of pants and a shirt so that he had something suitable that he could wear at the Passover. So again, was he naked? Well, he had clothes, but they didn't fit him as a result of the weight that he had gained. So he needed something, and so you simply provide that need. Now, I didn't spend a lot of money for that. I think at the end of the day, I think it was no more than about $10, $12, maybe $15. But there was somebody that was in need. I didn't go to Macy's and buy it off the rack. I didn't go to Joseph A. Banks and buy him a new suit for Passover. That's not what he needed. He simply needed clothes so that he could partake of the Passover. So you get my point. The point here is these are all simple things that the parable is talking about. You sometimes have people say, "Well, I need money. I need money." It's interesting. My wife and I will, again, on that trip between Eugene and Portland, and if nature calls sometimes, I've got to stop at the rest stop and use the bathroom. We see this one particular lady that is always at this one rest stop, just south of Wilsonville. I think we've seen her there every time I've had to stop at the rest stop. Always has the same sign there. Anything, you know, can you help? Anything helps, you know, God bless. It's the standard sign that you see from some of these people. I remember the one time we came and there was an individual, a young man, probably in his 30s, and he had this bag of groceries. And so he was trying to give it to this lady. You know, she's in this wheelchair, which again, I don't know if she actually had needed the wheelchair. I don't know. I'm not going to go that far. I'm not going to make that judgment. I have no idea. But he was offering her this bag of groceries. And they're saying, "I need help." And so he's offering this bag of groceries, and she refused the groceries. So the question says, well, I'm asking, I think myself, why do you need money? What specific reason are you needing money? So again, the help that is needed here that we're looking at this particular parable is the simple things. Jesus Christ is not making the statement that we have to go out and lend or give large sums of money to individuals. Again, there needs to be a point where we take the proverb into consideration that tells us that we are to be wise as a serpent and harmless as a dove. We don't want to get into simply a situation where we are facilitating someone's bad behavior. On the other hand, if someone has a need in this particular situation, they're hungry, they need food, they're thirsty, they're a stranger, they are naked, they need just some used clothing, something to get them by, they're sick, they're in prison, we visit them. It's help in the simple things. That's what that parable is showing us. What's the third thing we find from this parable? This parable is teaching us that it is what's referred to as uncalculating help. Uncalculating help. What do I mean by that? We don't do these acts of service in hopes of some sort of greater reward from the person. In other words, we're not simply saying, okay, if I do this, by extension, that means that they're going to do this for me. That's a calculating mentality. We're trying to figure out what we can do in order to get something in return. My wife and I watch a particular sitcom. Sometimes at the end of the day, we'll watch a few episodes, just kind of laugh before we call it a night and go to sleep. And in this one particular episode, the husband and wife, and the husband is planning this trip with his buddies, and they're going to go to Las Vegas for this weekend so they can spend time in Las Vegas. And so he's got to figure out a way that he can make it so his wife will allow him to go to Las Vegas with all his buddies, leave her at home. And so he's figuring out what can I do? You know, I got to do something, and I can do this, I can do that. And he's asking his buddies. No, he says, you got to do something that'll really put it over the top. So he comes up with this particular idea. You know, he'll take her to this wellness spa for the weekend, and she'll get a massage and all this pampering and this treatment and all this sort of stuff. But it's not selfless service for his wife. He's calculating what he can do so he can get something in return. That's not what the parable is talking about. The parable is not talking about doing something so that we can calculate what we get in return. We don't do those things thinking, okay, I'm going to get something from Jesus Christ. I'm going to get something from God. We're doing these things because we're told that is what you do. As a servant of God, as a member of God's family, that is what you do. It's the attitude of giving help and expecting nothing in return. You come back and understand that a heart of service does not look at the person and calculate, is this going to win me a gold star in God's eyes? That's not why someone should serve or give an act of service. Let's look at a passage of scripture here, Galatians chapter 5. Galatians chapter 5. Galatians chapter 5, verses 13 and 14. Galatians chapter 5, verses 13 and 14. Galatians chapter 5, beginning in verse 13, he says, "For you, brethren, have been called to liberty, only do not use liberty as an opportunity for the flesh, but through love serve one another. For all the law is fulfilled in one word, even in this, you shall love your neighbor as yourself." Now, there are two keys in this particular passage that I want to sort of point to. The first one is, he says, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. He talks in verse 13 about love serving one another. This type of love that we're talking about, I think we understand, is godly love. It is agape love. It is mercy and it is compassion. We understand when it comes to mercy and compassion and love that we cannot give beyond what our means are. In other words, we may not, physically speaking, be able to do certain things. You know, if you have your last $10 and you say, well, I've got my last $10 and I don't have any other money until the end of next week when I get paid again, and you're going to give that away to somebody and you've got nothing. I mean, there's certain things that we have to look at in terms of what we can do and going above and beyond our means. Giving money that we don't have, giving items that we don't have, giving things that are just simply not ours to give. We have to understand that. On the other hand, we also realize when it comes to love, there are certain things that it comes in terms of serving. We go back to our previous point, and that is it's the simple things. It's the simple things. It doesn't have to be a grandiose thing that is given in terms of monetary value. I guess that's the term I'm looking for. It's the attitude behind what we're doing that is most important. And that's where the love comes in, the compassion and the mercy. I'm going to read 1 Corinthians chapter 13. This is verses 4 through 7, often referred to, again, I know as the love chapter. 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verses 4 through 7. Now, I'm going to read it from the New Living Translation. That's a more modern translation, but you can follow along in whatever translation of the Bible you have. 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verses 4 through 7. In the New Living Translation, it says the following, beginning in verse 4. Love is patient and kind. Love is not jealous or boastful or proud or rude. It does not demand its own way. It is not irritable, and it keeps no record of being wronged. It does not rejoice about injustice, but rejoices whenever the truth wins out. Love never gives up, never loses faith, and is always hopeful and endures through every circumstance. So we understand that when it comes to love and the things that we do, again, the very first statement that's made there, it's patient, it's kind, it's not proud, it's not boastful, it's not rude. It does these things in all of a self-serving manner. That's the context with which we're talking about with the parable of the sheep and the goats. Expecting nothing in return. It is not calculating help. It's not determining, I'll help this person, but not that person. Now, I said there were two keys in this particular passage in Galatians chapter 5, verses 13 and 14, the first being love. The second term that he used here, he says, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Now, again, we go back to the question, who is our neighbor? Now, again, we go back and understand certain things when it comes to our neighbor. People will want to help anybody and everybody. I get that. I understand that. But when you have limited resources, I believe that Galatians chapter 6 and verse 10 is something that we have to look at very, very carefully. Galatians chapter 6 and verse 10, notice what it says. Therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all. So he's talking about everybody. So if you're talking about your neighbor, you can simply say, okay, I want to do good to all. But notice what he says. Especially to those who are of the household of faith. Especially to those that are the household of faith. Now, we have a lot of needs in the church today. I think everybody can go back to Mr. Meeker's sermon that he gave on the Sabbath before the first day of unleavened bread, the slideshow that he gave on the various countries in Africa. And you can take a look at all of those countries and say there are a lot of needs that our brethren have overseas. That was just Africa. That doesn't take into consideration some of those countries in Latin America. It doesn't take into consideration countries in Asia, the Philippines, you name it. There's a number of areas where we have God's people, part of our household, and they have need. So the context here that we go back to, who is my neighbor? If we have opportunity to do good, we are to love our neighbor. But again, remember what he says here, especially to those who are of the household of faith. We need to remember our spiritual family. I'm not saying that we look outside of our spiritual family, because our spiritual family are individuals that will at some point in the future be called. That could be your neighbor next door, across the street, whatever it might be. But don't neglect the household of faith. Don't neglect those that are of the family of God. Notice 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 8. 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 8. Again, under the same context that we talk about doing good, when we have opportunity, as Paul said, to do good. Notice what he says here in 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 8. Now, he's giving some instruction concerning the widows. And there's a statement that I want to make here when we read this one verse. Notice 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 8. He says, but if anyone does not provide for his own, and especially for those of his household, he is denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. Now, the context with which Paul is talking about here when he wrote this to Timothy has to do with someone providing for their physical family. That's what he's talking about. If someone does not provide for his own, because again, he is talking about the widows. If you go on, he talks in verse 9 about the widows. He is talking about those within a family. He's talking about in verse 5 here, the father, the younger men. He's talking about the makeup of the church in terms of younger men, younger women, older women. And then he gets into verse 8 where he talks about if you do not provide for your own, he's denying the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. That's context for the physical family. My point here was you could take a look at that scripture, and I believe that you could extrapolate and say, don't disconsider or do not neglect those of the spiritual household as well. That is what Paul was talking about back in Galatians chapter 6 and verse 10. Don't forget the spiritual family. Yes, the physical family is important, but don't forget the spiritual family. Notice Matthew chapter 5 and verse 44. Again, talking about this context, Matthew chapter 5 and verse 44. The context of who is my neighbor. And honestly, you get back to an understanding that your neighbor is anybody that you come in contact with. Are there members of your own household? That is correct, both physical and spiritual. And they all are to be taken care of. Matthew chapter 5 and notice verse 44. Start in verse 43. He says, you have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies, bless those who curse you, do good to those who hate you, and pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you. So again, a statement made here to serve your enemies. Sometimes serving an enemy may be nothing more than praying for somebody in a condition that they're in. Sometimes it's dealing with a situation of a person who may be an enemy, but you help them out in some particular way. And you can find that when you help them in some particular way, it tends to sometimes soften them. It surprises them. If you've ever had that situation happen before, someone who they would view you as an enemy, and you may have been in the outs with this particular person, and you do something kind for them, and suddenly they're like, they don't know what to do. They're showered with this kindness. They just simply don't know what to do. Again, the context here is what Jesus is saying, even in case of an enemy, you are to love your enemies and at times serve your enemies. I don't have the time to go through the parable, but Luke chapter 10, verses 26 through 37 is the parable of the Good Samaritan. I would encourage you, if you can, either later tonight after the study's over or sometime maybe tomorrow, while this study is still fresh in your mind, go through the parable of the Good Samaritan. I believe it is very interesting what Jesus Christ did. He used the Samaritans. The Jews and the Samaritans were the Hatfields and the McCoys of the ancient world. They hated each other. They despised each other. Again, it goes back in the history, back to the Babylonian Empire, and again, how the Samaritans oppressed the Jews, and the Jews never forgot that. And so there's been that they're at each other's throats. Jesus would use the Samaritan, the parable of the Samaritan, to talk about the need to help and serve someone who is their neighbor. The neighbor is someone who must be taken care of. In this case, he's saying even the Samaritan, who you despise and you hate, must be taken care of. They are your neighbor. Again, we understand that the help we give to our neighbor must be reasonable and it must be safe. What do we mean by that? Well, let's look at Proverbs chapter 3. Proverbs chapter 3. This goes back to the statement of how far do I go in helping somebody? I'm not going to, after giving this Bible study, shut everything down, put my shoes and socks on, and I can go literally no more than about 2 miles from where we live right here, and I can come to any one of a number of homeless encampments. I'm not going to sit there with a bag of cookies or a loaf of bread and give them food. I'm not going to do that. There's a point of being reasonable and safe in what we do. We need to take that into consideration. That's part of what I referred to before as being wise as a serpent and harmless as a dove. We need to understand the context with which we're dealing with. Even Jesus Christ, when everything he was dealing with was safe in terms of what he did, he had the disciples with him. He had the apostles around him. There was a certain level of security, I guess you could say, that he had. So we need to understand that we have to be reasonable and safe. Notice what it says here in Proverbs chapter 3. Proverbs chapter 3, verses 28 and 29. Proverbs chapter 3, verses 28 and 29. He says, "Do not say to your neighbor, 'Go and come back, and tomorrow I will give it,' when you have it with you. Do not devise evil against your neighbor, for he dwells by you for safety's sake." So his point here is that if you have the help to give, give it. But it must be a situation where it is reasonable and it's safe in order to do that for an individual. We don't want to put ourselves at risk. We don't want to put our families at risk. If we have that opportunity to serve, we do it with safety, in the right manner, in the right way. The fourth thing that we learn from the parable of the sheep and the goats is this: the help that is given to God. It is not given to man. Remember the context with which he said, "When did we see you hungry? When did we see you thirsty? When did we see you naked?" And he says, "If you have done it to them, you have done it to me." The physical act of service represents a far greater principle. We are serving God when we are serving our fellow man. That is what Jesus is representing here. Notice back in Matthew chapter 25. I'm going to finish up just with a couple of scriptures here. Matthew chapter 25. They made that question. Yeah, they could not figure it out. How is it that you were sick? You weren't sick. We've been with you the whole time. You've never been in prison. When were you hungry? When were you thirsty? When were you not clothed? You've always been clothed around us. And then when he says, "When you've done it to these," he says, look what he says here in verse 40. "And the king will answer," Matthew chapter 25, verse 40, "and the king will answer and say to them, 'Assuredly, I say to you, insomuch as you did it to one of the least of these, my brethren, you did it to me.'" That is the point. The help, while we may give it to a person physically, is ultimately going to God. It is being done to Jesus Christ. Why is that important? Notice Matthew chapter 6 and verse 4. Matthew chapter 6 and verse 4. Matthew chapter 6 and verse 4. Notice what he says here. Matthew chapter 6 and verse 4. He says, talking about charitable deeds, he says that your charitable deed may be in secret, and that your Father who sees in secret will himself reward you openly. No reward for service is going to come from man. We shouldn't do it with a design to get some form of of reward from man. But the point being here in this parable is that when we are doing this, while we think we are doing it to another physical human being, what Jesus Christ said is, when you do that to that human being, you are actually doing it to me. You give them drink, you're actually giving me drink. You're giving them food, you're actually giving me food, and so on and so forth. You get the point that we're talking about. The reward is not going to come from the person. The reward is going to come from God the Father and Jesus Christ. The parable of the sheep and the goats is about judgment. We are going to be judged for doing good to all, not just our close friends or those that we want something in return. We need to make certain and sure, however, that when we are serving in this selfless service, the selfless act of service, that we are not facilitating bad behavior. And as we do those things, we want to make certain and sure that what we are doing is reasonable, what we are doing is safe. We want to make certain and sure that we understand that it's the simple things that Jesus Christ was talking about. That's what he's talking about when you look at those instances of help: food, shelter, help when they're sick, visiting, care for a person when they're in prison, those sorts of things. We don't want to facilitate bad behavior. We want to be able to help. Ultimately, first and foremost, I simply state that we want to take care of the household of faith. And then ultimately, as again, we are commanded to, we move outside of that into those that might be outside of that particular group. There's a lot of things that we can do within the household of faith, no question about it. Does that mean we have to limit it to just the household of faith? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Doing good works, being a light to the world, is something we are called to do. but we have to make certain and ensure that we are balancing what we do in terms of what we do in acts of service. And remember that always those acts that we do, whether they are within the household of faith or outside of the household of faith, those that ultimately will be called by God, ultimately those are actions that are actually showing our service and giving to God. That's it for the Bible study this evening. I hope that you have found that helpful and valuable. And as I said, if you wouldn't mind, I think it would be good. While it's fresh on your mind, doesn't have to be tonight. You can do it tomorrow. But just before you forget about the Bible study this evening, go back through the parable of the Good Samaritan, because I do think it's good to review when we talk about this subject of service.